It's Ken Bergen here, and welcome to the HOSPO Reset podcast. Each episode, I explore trends, innovation, and smart thinking in the hospitality industry with a particular focus on restaurants, cafes, and food service. You'll find the show notes and links for today's episode on your podcast app and look for the link at the top of the hosporeset.com website. Don't forget to subscribe to the weekly HOSPO Reset newsletter and connect with me on LinkedIn and on Twitter. Hey, it's Ken Bergen here from the HOSPO Reset podcast. Today I'm talking to Diane McGrath from the Fight Food Waste Cooperative Research Centre about strategies and solutions for reducing food waste. Diane's been a hero of mine for quite a few years. I've sort of watched her work, which included a PhD on the topic of food waste and, sustainability and all those good words. But I think it kind of encompasses productivity and efficiency, which are maybe words that are we kind of relate to a little bit more. Anyway, terminology is something we might discuss, but we got lots to talk about. Hey, Diane, great to have you here today.
Yeah, great to reconnect with you again, Ken. I love the work that you've been doing over the years in how our sector in the food service industry can be more efficient as a whole, and whether that's with food or with people or our operating processes. Mm. So
well, I think that when you say cost control, people do lean forward. My thing is about bottom line profits for businesses. Say cost control and yes, tell me more. You say, how can we grow your sales and all this? Yeah. I mean, they want to do it, but it feels harder. But the cost control side, and that's really you're right in the center of that, a lot of solutions for that.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting you think about that perspective. It's like the dollar really does trigger a lot of activity for businesses, doesn't it? What they choose to do and what approaches they take. If we think about what are the major costs any business has, so it could be the rental side of stuff. It's their staffing costs, but it's also their food and beverage purchases too. That's a huge part, often up to about a third of the cost. And a lot of businesses don't really track how efficient they are with their food and beverage use. They'll track their staff time minute to minute, but their food and beverage use, not the same, which is crazy because it's about
interesting.
The same cost.
So let's just go back a little bit to the research and the PhD you did, which was going into venues and kind of looking what was on the plate and what was happening in the kitchen. And I know you've got a family background in catering and the food industry. You don't come to it as a stranger. Yeah, what are some of the findings you found and some of the things that might surprise people?
The first thing is the surprise factor. As you, even that word itself, people were surprised about how much food they were really wasting. When you had businesses audit their own waste, like basically just weigh it or even estimate based on how much they had in a container, a known volume container, for the different service periods, for a day and once a week or once a month or once a day. In some businesses, did it daily. And we wanted to see if by paying attention to it, did it change? Did they decide to actually make any changes to their behaviour at all? Because it would have told them, oh, we're efficient or not. And businesses were quite surprised by how much they were actually calculating as waste each day. And it turned out to be roughly about 100 grams per cover, which is, if you think about that, 100 grams of food, what's that? That's quite a bit. If you take that across the whole year, depending upon what the food is, it turns out to be something like about $50,000 worth of
food. Yeah, well, 1,000 customers a week, that's 100 kilos, isn't it? That's a lot of food.
It's a lot of food. And what's that? If you then look at that other big cost of businesses like their FTEs, that's like what, for each year, it's like 1.5 to 2 FTE, like they could possibly have.
FTE, what's the FTE?
So full-time equivalent, so staff.
Okay.
Cost of 1.5 to 2 staff members a year and food is wasted, which is, people are scratching for staff at the moment in the current environment. What you wouldn't give to be able to have good staff at the sort of...
And if you can bring those costs down of your kind of cost of goods, you actually can afford to pay a little bit more, which is absolutely an attraction to get more staff. If you're still trying to pay bare minimum, no wonder you're scratching for people.
And it's one of the things that was fascinating about the research, Ken, was that businesses were seeing the first time they started measuring the waste, they saw that most of it was actually occurring on the plate, so out front of house.
What was left behind.
Exactly, what was left behind.
Right,
so this is the oversupply, overproduction.
Yeah. I remember when you, for hearing one of your presentations, that really struck me. It's like, wow, really? I mean, it's sort of you've got a fussy child and you're expecting But I actually kind of ever since, even last night, I was eating in a pub and just watching what people left on their plate. It's just like, really? Wow. And pub food, you think big plates and big portions. It's,
Yes, and so that really, that was in some ways not a surprise, because you do go out and you see this. Although, of course, most people say, oh, it's not me though. Which is funny, because, and I'll talk about this too, if you like, I've done some research with diners. Don't our businesses want to know what their customers are doing and thinking? Well, I can tell you some of that.
Yeah.
But the businesses were seeing that more than half of the food they were wasting was actually on the diner's plate. So what we saw pretty quickly was that started to shift. So the businesses, as they continued to track their waste over time, started to see less of it happening on the plate, and proportionally, but small amounts. So the overall amount reduced of food being wasted, but it was then starting to be in the kitchen. So what does that tell you? What you start to pay attention to, you do something about. So
what you can measure, you can manage. Yeah. Yes.
What was coming back from the kitchen? Oh, there's an excess of toast. There's more salad than what we need. There's a huge serve of chips or whatever it might be. And so what we started to see, what businesses were doing, smart little subtle changes, such as reducing portion sizes, the logical thing, or even
unnecessary garnishes.
Absolutely.
One of my least favourite things, snow pea sprouts. Most flavourless things in the world.
Absolutely.
It's put on the top of everything. No one eats.
And what we interviewed, one of the participants was, can't say which business it was, but it was part of a franchise. And one of the things they found frustrating about being a franchise is, of course, there's such a specific meal that you have to provide, X amount of grams of salad, for example, X amount of grams of fries, a sandwich which has so many slices of whatever. So it's very prescriptive on what had to be on the plate. Uh-huh. But they found that they were able to still have some discussion with the customer. So their discussions included, did you want the side salad or would you prefer the chips? So they started actually having a bit of a negotiation.
Right.
Made the customer much happier with what they got.
Yeah, interesting.
The customer didn't feel they were wasting something because they were paying for that thing they weren't eating. They ate everything they were paying for. So it's an interesting relationship, isn't it? You sort of think, wouldn't you want the extra? But the customer actually preferred it.
So for our food service operator, just start measuring, start watching. I know a chef that I really admire. One way he kind of tackled this initially was everyone who was working a big kitchen, everyone had their little waste box on top of the bench, and it went in there. Nothing went into the bin. I mean, eventually it did.
Yeah.
But just that visibility there with trim and, you know, prep and things like that got to the point there was almost nothing being wasted.
It's such a small thing to do, to actually just start to measure something. And it doesn't have to be tracked to the nth degree and, you know, calculated to the gram or whatever. You start to, something of size, as soon as you have something of volume, like large enough size, you can do something with that.
Yeah. And one of the tools that I'm always very insistent with operators is they get really good electronic scales in the kitchen.
Yeah.
You know, just like you just put the bowl on, you correct for the weight of the bowl or whatever or not. But they're always on. They're on the shelf in the middle of everything, whether you're weighing prawns or burgers or whatever. But now we're going to actually weigh what came back maybe once or twice a day. Yeah, nice. Interesting.
Some businesses are quite good at estimating, like some of the chefs who are more experienced, for example, are quite good at estimating portion size.
Yeah.
Like they'll be doing they might be doing prep work or whatever, and they'll know what a 200 gram piece of salmon.
Yeah, sure.
Very experienced. But the younger staff aren't. That takes time.
Yes.
So having that structure of being able to weigh, this is a standard portion, and then be able to eyeball it.
And I think knowing the actual cost of like one prawn or one scallop is a real eye-opener for people. And if you've got proper costing scales, it's done instantly, and then you might decide, well, actually it's three prawns on this dish, not four, again, because the fourth one might come back.
Well, yeah, and even that point that you raise then, Ken, about knowing the cost of every ingredient that's on that plate, that's on that menu item. I mean, obviously that's the recipe design that's done by the chef, executive chef in many businesses. We'll know the cost of a plate and we'll know the profit per plate. But there are subtle tweaks you can make by ingredient that can increase the profit per plate at the same time as reducing the amount that's going to be left on the plate. Like you say, one less prawn and maybe a tiny bit more salad, like, because the prawn will be coming with something else usually. What could that be that'll still be eaten?
Yeah. Now, tell us, on your website, on the homepage, you've got a figure down the bottom, the value chain food waste losses in Australia, $20 billion per annum, and two-thirds of that's from either food service or household. The half of all of that is actually household, but food services. But I'm just curious about that other third, which is agriculture, harvesting, food processing, distribution, all the rest. And you and I both saw a dramatic figure that was circulating on social media and some new items in Australia this week, which was all these truckloads of avocados going to the green waste tip up in Queensland.
Yes.
Yeah, there's something almost emotional about, I was thinking, if that was kind of building waste, it would be, well, it just fills up an empty hole or something like that. But something emotional about seeing that much happening.
And what is only so much smashed avo you can make, right?
Yeah, that's right. And reading this article more, people who with some knowledge were saying there's so much, going to be so much overproduction in the next few years. Apparently, Western Australia has got hundreds of acres of avocado trees growing and things. So, yeah, well, what's your take on that? And
It's obviously heartbreaking to see such great produce go to waste, because as you talk about that whole supply chain where you're looking from the farm to our businesses, the food can get spoilt, obviously, along that way. And so food is lost before it even gets to us, and it might arrive to us, like such as products such as avocados, which can be damaged quite easily in transport. So if we end up, like, say, for example, potatoes, only about half of all potatoes that are grown for human consumption are actually eaten. So if we think about where they get wasted along that supply chain all the way back.
Or are they just too small or wrong size or ugly?
Lots of different reasons. And some of it is because of definitely the specs, wrong size, wrong shape, damaged in pulling out of the ground. Because, of course, it's anything you have to pull out of the ground, there's a risk of damage as opposed to harvest from tree, which is there's risk to that too. But machinery is used to pull something out of the ground can actually damage the stock sometimes. So there's new technology and ideas that are coming through in that space, which is going to be fascinating, as well as technology to identify the quality of the grade of the product as at farm gate to identify the best opportunity for it. Is it going to be good to turn this straight into chips with the large producers or manufacturers, or do we keep this whole and it's going to be fantastic on a plate? So that sort of technology will be invaluable to farmers to make the most of that product. But if we think about the current situation where about half of it isn't consumed at some stage, if farmers only had to grow half of the potatoes that they do because we actually were better at using it, because a lot of it's too many chips on the plate, for example, then perhaps there would be less land degradation as well, less water needed by farmers, much less fuel needed to transport.
Yeah. So there are market forces, which mean obviously people are planting a lot more avocados because they're seeing, wow, look, they're all $2 each or the high prices. But it seems like a very inefficient market in that, and what you're saying is, why is potato production not being dramatically scaled back so we got just enough and prices are higher? What's your thoughts on the kind of the market for agricultural goods that's producing this kind of ups and downs?
It's a challenge, and I think I'm not really educated to speak on the market per se at the agricultural level, but it does make me think about the value element of overproduction, which our businesses can think about day to day in their own stores.
Yeah.
If we think about what happened, everyone would have experienced this at some stage during various lockdowns throughout the last couple of years. There was a glut or surplus of product in store. What did you do with it? Some businesses had the capacity to on-sell. Some businesses had the capacity to preserve. Some businesses just wasted it. Others donated it to food rescue. So what are the options that businesses have to manage surpluses that then can create either market opportunities for them or ensure it gets to still feed hungry people?
Yeah, interesting. And just like from the restaurant point of view, the market for, I think of like local takeaway shops at kind of 4:30, 5 o'clock, they have this table out the front, full of boxes of half price, quarter price, the salads and all sorts of things which weren't sold during the day, and perfectly good food. But they've got a kind of market thing happening there too. Low price, clear the goods and start fresh tomorrow. But seems like venues, I mean, they're specifically a type of takeaway place, but venues don't have such good, they don't like the idea of discounting. It's just an interesting conundrum, I think.
It is an interesting conundrum. And is there other solutions that businesses could think about when it comes to the end of day stock? Could it be, instead of discounted, could it be something which is donated?
Yeah.
And so there's a social good that comes from it, and they end up with, as we know, the business, when it comes to the value of a business, there's also that social good that the business owns as well, their reputation and the like. Now, one of the projects that we've had at the Fight Food Waste CRC, the Cooperative Research Centre, has been working in the development of an app where businesses could potentially create a donation of a left, whatever meals might be remaining at the end of the day, those surpluses, to people who may need a meal. Almost like through an app, through a voucher type system, where someone comes in to get almost the equivalent of like a takeaway.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like it's being discounted per se, but it gives them a social good.
And it's just a time-based thing, really. And if they're hanging around waiting for the price to come down, so be it. That's okay.
Yeah, and it's interesting, one of the other projects that the Cooperative Research Centre has been working on as well is around some sort of tax rebate or incentive for businesses to donate more food to food rescue. So could this be the sort of thing, and this is just a question at the moment, could this be something that ties in and supports businesses to have a good social value out of what's left at the
end? So you can donate cash and get a tax deduction, but you can't donate $100 worth of surplus food.
No, you can, but you can write stuff off, as you know. Businesses will often write off wastage each year, and it's almost a given that there's going to be about a 5% written off for the year. So if that can go to a different sort of value proposition for the business, then that could be an attractive thing. And it's I'll send you the link so you've got a picture of what that incentive
we'll
proposal
that.
Looks like.
Okay. So you've got on your website, you've got a huge number of projects there. And you said that the reduce column, which is only about 20 different projects or so there, are ones you're particularly focused on. Tell us about some of those, some other ones of those that would have particular interest for restaurant and cafe food service operators.
Well, actually, a bit of a sneak preview here,
yes,
Ken.
Please.
This one is not yet up on the website, but it will be in the not too distant future. And this has a lot of value, I think, to our businesses. And this is date mark labelling. So we've got a project that we're in development with at the moment, which is about the date mark labelling for product. So
this is like the use by or the best by dates, which can, and interesting, even just having those two things kind of straight away, there's confusion, isn't there? Tell us more.
There's a simple win for some of that, isn't it? It's like, why do companies have two? Just take one off. Number one, that's one less label that needs to be stuck on a piece of real estate for a manufacturer, but for then either a customer who's the commercial customer, like our businesses, or a householder, then you've only got one thing you need to worry about. And we know from the research, and this is one of the other research projects that the Engage team at the CRC have run with households, we know that only about half of people know what both a use by and a best by date is.
Right.
Now, this is
you'd better explain the difference for us.
Well, let's see, and if you think about whatever we do at home, we're going to do at work as well.
Yeah.
If only half of us at home know what these two things are, then you can guarantee that only half
and
of us.
And that's an interesting point too, that kind of the domestic way of kind of production does, you know, it's a commercial food operators, but it's surprising how many of those kind of home systems kind of seep in.
Yeah, and it's one of the main reasons that people throw away food at home is because they're really not quite sure if it's still safe.
Yeah.
So they pitch it out, whether it's the leftover takeaway from 3 days ago, which is probably perfectly fine. In fact, if it's a curry, it probably tastes better. But if it's a date label reason, it's just because they're confused.
Yeah.
So the simple solutions.
So use by is further out than best by, is that right?
Well, the use by date is the critical one for both businesses and households because that's the one that's about safety.
Okay.
So, and in fact, I tend to think in my mind when I'm looking at something and there might be a couple of dates, I just go straight to the use by because I think use it or lose it.
Yes.
Okay. So it makes me, it's easy to remember for me then.
Right. And so Best Buy will be shorter dated, might be
Best Buy will, before. Best Buy is completely subjective.
Okay. It's so it's actually just a makeup.
It is. It's made up. It's made up by the company that produces the food. Okay. Uh-huh. About, and that's about their perceived quality. So what they think is the food might be at its peak by that date. And after that date, it may degrade in quality. And I say quality in inverted commas there because what is quality?
Yeah, it might just be a little bit drier or
drier,
yeah, change colour a little bit or something.
And even then, it may not do so at all. If we think about some of the food that we, you know, we might sniff or taste or whatever that's well past the date, and we don't know whether that date is used by Best Buy, it doesn't matter. If we smell it and taste it, it's perfectly fine.
Yeah.
It's probably perfectly fine.
Yeah. So what's the new project? What's that category?
Well, that project, it's a multi-stage project. The first one is to really understand what people do with the food as it's getting closer to that date.
Okay.
Because if we take, for example, bread. Let's look at bread's a great example.
Yes, okay.
Where is the date on bread? It's on the tab usually, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right, you get those plastic.
I'm just thinking, where is it? Yeah, I'd never look.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
Do people even look at the date on bread or they just keep using it until it's gone?
Yeah.
Or gone green. So in our households, it's on the tab, and it often is in our businesses too. A lot of small businesses will purchase the bread from the large suppliers, and of course it's, you know, I won't name brands, but all those brands have the label in the same place. It's on that tab. And whether that tab's the plastic tab or in some instances these days, those cardboard tabs, which break apart more easily. Do people keep the tab on? Yes, no.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people throw it away.
It's the first thing to go, isn't it?
First thing to go. And then what do? They leave the bread in the plastic bag, which then doesn't steal quite as well, or do they portion it off and put some in the freezer? And so what we're trying to do with this first phase of the research is understand, I'd use bread as an example, but understand what people are actually doing with particular food categories. And those categories are the ones that are the hot spots, like which ones are people wasting the most?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So we're thinking about things which are often in the refrigerator. So we're thinking about maybe we'll look at dairy in particular. It's an area, it's a concern. Maybe bread, perhaps some meat products.
Yeah, I'd say dairy would be a top priority, wouldn't it? Because people are quite sensitive to dates and everyone's had a curdle bottle of milk they've had to tip out.
And yet in a business, what would you do with a curdled bottle of milk? It makes great bread.
Yeah.
I use it whenever there's some milk or cream or something of that nature that might go out of date and it's a bit like, oof, yeah, I'm not going to put that on the cereal or in my tea. It becomes, I put it in my baking.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Interesting. What's some other projects in the reduce kind of list that you think are particularly relevant for our food service operators?
Some I can't talk about yet, but you keep your eye out for a few in the food service area and institutions, so the healthcare side of stuff. And
it's
probably worth talking about this in the team with the team here as well, because of course there's a number of aged care institutions that will often get catered in.
And massive users of food, of course.
Absolutely, massive users of food. And when we have a look at the amount of food that's wasted in the food service sector, which is, it's roughly about $8 billion worth a year for this whole sector.
Wow.
The majority of that $6.5 billion is with our commercial side, but the other $1.5 roughly is with that institutional side. So hospitals, aged care, maybe schools and prisons and so forth, but mostly from the healthcare side. Mm-hmm. It's a huge amount of waste. And the large catering organisations will sometimes be the B2B, be the supplier of food to some of those aged care facilities, for example. So what can we learn there to be more efficient with the food management, ordering, understand what the resident needs? Because they're a customer too.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting. From a different perspective. They're not a diner that sits into a beautiful five-star restaurant, but they're still someone that has choice of food, and what we provide to them still has to meet their needs nutritionally, as satisfying, enjoyable. Otherwise, they're going to go get takeaway.
Yeah. You've got a mention there about harvesting and packaging of prawns too. And my guess is, I don't know exact figures, but you know, most of the prawns in kind of low cost meals we have would be imported frozen ones, but still quite a substantial industry locally. Tell us about what's happening there.
Some of the stuff in the prawn project is really interesting. They're looking across how we can improve through the canning process, like the onboard processing of prawns, can we ensure that more product is going to make it to market? And so, and we talked about a little bit about productivity and efficiency before.
What is the kind of percentage now that's actually onboard processing that ends up as waste rather than?
I haven't got that figure right to hand, I'm afraid, Ken, but I can send you the link to that project details and some.
Must be something notable though.
Millions of dollars worth of stuff. They could, the amount of potential market value
goes over the edge, I suppose, of the boat and turns into fish food.
Well, and what else could we do with that food as well? And so part of this project is, yes, improve the onboard processing, but what else is happening? Identifying that, I guess, mapping out where waste is occurring for that product. Because they could, if we could have more local product to market, then what does that mean? I mean, it means as well there could be a different grading of product. It could be different, I guess, cost points for product in market too. A lot of opportunities both for seller and buyer. So improving the efficiency of food at the productivity side, at agricultural side, at fishing, when it comes to meat as well. We've got a meat livestock project in place too. How is meat?
What sort of things is that looking at? What are the problem areas there you've identified?
Well, they're trying to, and this is a new project that only started last year. So what they're doing with the meat and livestock project, Ken, in our reduce program, and I've moved on to another program now, but I know these projects relatively well, is they've been mapping meat across the supply chain. So from farm, all the way through to when it gets to the end user, so the market. And from that, we're also looking at what's happening, how is meat being stored in the household? But what's happening in our refrigerators? And this and while this is once again is a household aspect, this particular one looking at refrigeration use in household in light or thought of use of meat, there's a lot to be known there. What we will learn from that could have application for our food service businesses too, because some businesses, when it comes to management of cold chain, you know, the refrigeration technology is not vastly different to some of the smaller scale businesses as it is to what...
And a lot of a small operator that has maybe one or two-door fridges but everything's in it together, the doors being open all the time. And they know we've got to be below 5 degrees, but it might be 4 degrees, whereas if they could keep it at 1.5 or have a separate fridge, there's going to be a massive improvement in life of that product.
Absolutely. And I've just finished a project with a group of students who did a fantastic research project for us to identify the sort of storage recommendations for a range of different products for refrigeration in particular. So if we think about fridge use for, say, cheeses, other dairy sorts of products. And they range everything from store in a cold place to keep at a very specific temperature.
Right.
You know, 5 degrees.
Place, that could be 8 or 10 degrees, couldn't it?
Exactly. It's very subjective. Yeah. So there's I think if you think about the human behaviour of that, if you've got such diversity of instructions about how to store the same sort of product, what do?
Interesting, a lot of electronic tracking of temperatures and sensors now, very cheap, very widespread, comes back to your phone. You can actually be woken at night if the refrigeration goes down. But I think lots of possibilities there, lots of potential. And the smart operators that I talk to, they just kind of jump straight on that little sensors connected up to the Wi-Fi network. It's exciting
stuff. And if you've got a large, as you talk about some of the smarter operators, probably have a couple of larger scale places for the refrigeration and freezing. And so you're able to as well have separate locations at the right sort of temperature zones for the right foods, because something that might, if we think about the small operators that might only have a two-door here or whatever, and they've got everything in the same fridge, you'll find that things such as cucumbers will spoil at a low temperature that you need to keep that temperature, like say 4 degrees, is too cold for a cucumber.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
But it's perfect for cheese. So if you put them all in together, your cucumber's going to be gone way faster than it needs to be.
So much interesting stuff here.
So
we've got some scraps and waste, and it goes into the bin. And way back in history, it used to go to a pig farmer or something like that, but that's all changed.
What are the chooks?
Yeah, or the chooks. But people love the idea of being able to compost, but end of the night, it's been a big night and we've kind of just scraped plates and everything. But what are some practical commercial options coming up for composting or using that right at the end of the chain where it's going to be either in the bin or maybe there's another use we could use for it? What have you seen happening?
And you're right, Ken, there is always going to be some waste. It's I know some businesses see it as an inevitable part of doing business, and it will occur because there will be the burnt toast, there will be the stock receipt that's broken, there'll be a number of reasons why something, the fridge might break down, there could be a number of reasons why waste might occur. And so we have to be able to still manage it. Some instances, of course, that can be turned into another food product, such as I talked about, the milk that goes bad could be turned into bread. And bread that becomes stale, hello breadcrumbs. And these are the sorts of things that people who are quite experienced in their businesses know they can use the older product for. Same thing with if you've had marinated vegetables as part of a platter over time, then the hello vegetable lasagna the next day. So lots of clever menu design for specials or use of other ingredients. But there's still going to be some waste.
There's still going to be the scraping off the plate.
You can't use that again. There is, of course, offering it to the diner to take home. And that's when I did in my PhD.
Interesting.
I did some surveys with diners as well. So I surveyed hundreds of diners across Australia to understand how they, did they leave waste when the last went out? How much did they leave on the plate? And also, did they get offered a doggy bag? Did they want one? Out of the people who left food, so about nearly 30% of diners had left food. So I was surprised it was actually that high. I thought it'd be less because it's funny how you put yourself in people's shoes.
Yeah, it's the importance of actually counting things, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Really, that many people left food?
Yeah.
So nearly a third of people left food when they last went out. And they leave about 15% of the meal.
Right.
So what does that mean? Well, it depends on the size of the serving, doesn't it? But a standard serve in many places is at least half a kilo these days. If you look at the total weight of product on plate, 200 gram of this and 100 gram of that, 100, so nearly about half a kilo. So you could be looking at anywhere up to about, 60, 75 grams per plate.
Yeah, interesting. I know if you go to your favourite Vietnamese or Thai place, they just kind of know that they'll just bring you either they'll do it for you or they'll bring you a plastic box you can take home. But it almost feels a bit kind of, not quite the thing to do if you're sort of at the pub or in a restaurant, but a nice thing to encourage for sure.
Yeah, indeed. And it's expected in other restaurants overseas of high quality. If you go to, say, the US, for example, the doggy bag is a part of standard. But it's not here for the same standard.
A few years ago, there was important food safety concerns and there was lots of things about the temperature and actually even no doggy bags allowed and all this. And people will do what they do if they leave it on the back seat of the car and then still want to eat it in the morning. But it seems like we threw out the baby with the bathwater then.
I think so. And there's no law that prohibits doggy bags at all. And in fact, in every single state in Australia and territory, doggy bags are permitted. In Queensland law, it even states that it's the customer that owns that food. Well, that makes sense. By contract,
they pick it up and walk out.
So they have the choice about what they wish to do with it, if you think about it. But businesses haven't sort of thought about that aspect of things.
Yeah.
So I think perhaps behaviourally, maybe the dollar exchange has been based on that engagement. Someone's come in and eaten there rather than the food being the thing. It's part of that engagement to take home too. So when I asked the diners in the survey, would you have liked a doggy bag? About two-thirds of them said they would have liked to have been offered a doggy bag. But
nice. So they wanted one. Interesting. Very interesting.
But they were a bit afraid to ask for it, though. That's the thing. Culturally.
So in certain restaurants, like an Asian restaurant, it's kind of like it's cool. That's just what you do. But others not so much.
Yeah, and it does depend, of course, on the type of food that's left too.
Mm.
Will you take home the soggy chips? Not necessarily. But then again, there we go. How many chips are given out on the plate? Do we need that many? So the type of food makes a difference. And it seems that the sort of takeaway that people get and leave in their fridge the most common sort of stuff tends to be of Italian nature, i.e. think pizza. Or some sort of curry or Asian sort of dish. Sorts of things that are okay to have again. That conception of, oh, that's fine the next day. I can reheat that. So what is left, though? Half a bite of a burger, much less likely to be taken home.
Yeah, interesting. What's some other low-hanging fruit that you see for the operators that they could be starting to hack into, well, not just waste and costs with kind of daily, weekly production and the rhythms of their activity?
I think the first thing, other than doing an audit, of course, once again, once you know where
you are. An audit would be a great project for an apprentice or some young person who's just, that's their thing, because it's easily the person in charge of the kitchen is like too busy, whatever.
And in fact, I reckon that's probably where you're going to get the most information too, because they're probably going to be the dishies as well, aren't they?
Yes, yeah.
So they're going to be the ones that see what comes back on the plate.
Yeah.
That could be some of the easy wins to know. Oh, guys, you know that no one's eating garnish.
Yes.
Let's not bother about this.
All those no peace.
Yeah, exactly. And the other area is there's some interesting research from the US that shows that chefs know that a diner won't recognize if a portion is about 10 to 15% smaller.
Ah, interesting. Okay.
So we could have a really subtle, like 10% is not a lot, is it?
Yeah, okay. And if we've got our electronic scales, we can actually calibrate that really carefully.
Yeah,
like a burger, 200-gram burger might turn into 180 grams. Yeah.
And is anyone going to notice that?
Yeah.
You know, 20 grams isn't a great deal. You don't really notice that. But if we think back again to what came out of my diner research, when diners said they were leaving about 15% of their meal, and here we are, chefs. This is well over a couple of hundred chefs in the US that have been in the business for a long time saying people won't miss 15%, 10 to 15%.
It's like, and this is where the magic of plating and what the type of plate we put it on, the size of the plate and the garnish, good garnishing, sides, all that can come into
plate
it.
Plate size makes a big difference. And we see the clever operators who have buffets have done this quite well by offering smaller plates at the buffet and people can welcome.
Yes.
And there's a lot less then that is left on the table. And so smaller amounts are then taken as well from buffet. And so that's, of course, production. You can produce a little bit less because buffet is a tricky one.
Yeah.
You always want to have some there. So it's
got to look abundant, but interesting. Well, I've seen that, you know, caterers and wedding venues that do that with the dessert buffet now too, because the old dessert on every plate, and you know that more than half will not be touched because people are too drunk or just not interested or didn't even notice it was there at that stage. But the dessert buffet can look fabulous and really enticing, and the sugarholics can go nuts and others.
And we can manage smaller volumes of it then too.
Yeah,
And because, of course, in this relatively almost moving towards post-COVID world, people are still quite sensitive to the buffet kind of arrangements about having people close together and so forth.
Yeah,
and single portioning is still a very attractive
let's grab that opportunity when we sort of had a cold stop to buffets. Let's maybe,
exactly. And one of the things that's very clever about some of the top operators with buffets is they have almost a threshold or a trigger to when they open up a new station. So as you're aware, many of the buffets will have multi-stations.
Yes.
But you know, you don't need to have every station open at the same time, and you don't need to have every bain-marie with something in it at that same time. There's ways of still making the bain-marie look abundant without having five trays in it. So cleverly.
Yeah, I see people using like cast iron pots and things like that on hot rather than the big gastronome trays and all those. So it looks more kind of appetizing, and actually the portion sizes are way more. And then that's constantly refreshed if actually we're selling out a lot and a new one comes out. But we're actually.
Which is as a diner, I love it when I see something fresh coming out.
Yeah, that's and it feels a little bit more homely in a way. Yeah. Just to wrap up, just on our QSRs, you mentioned briefly about franchises before, but I mean, they're such a massive user of food and the standardization, et cetera. What have you seen that the clever ones are doing around this, or what are some of the initiatives you've been watching?
We've seen a lot of use of online very cleverly with some of the top QSRs in this sort of space. And I think about, if we think about online food delivery as well, some of the big QSRs, so much of their business these days is a mix between takeaway and online delivery.
Yes.
Very little in-store.
Yeah.
No more than about a third. The rest of it is mostly takeaway or online delivery. And all the big QSRs are on OFDs, online food delivery, platforms of some capacity. But the really clever ones that are still doing things that give customer choice and options to encourage the idea of reducing waste.
Yes.
If you look at, I'll give an example, not because I think they're the best in the world, but a great example is if you open up, say, MenuLog, or one of the big apps, and go to McDonald's, for example, and try and order a quarter pounder. You go to order a quarter pounder on a MenuLog app, you have the option to remove almost everything in that quarter pounder.
Right, okay.
There's a section in the order where you can remove the bun, which is great for people who don't want a bun. Or you can even remove the burger.
Yeah, okay.
And there's a cost reduction.
So it's not just add-ons, it's minuses options as
correct.
Well.
So isn't that attractive as a customer? It's like, I can really customise what I want.
Yeah, because I know when I talk to operators they have fantastic success with promoting add-ons for those, and they continually amazed at the things that people will add. But that kind of decrement, the minus thing, is an interesting option having that too.
I love it.
It'll be the bit that I actually didn't want. I might replace it with mushrooms or something
like that. Exactly. It's like, I really don't like cheese, but I would love, if you could put a mushroom in that instead. So, there's a lot more flexibility. A really clever QSR and OFD, so they're the platforms.
Yeah.
The ones that have a good relationship will develop that sort of solution together. But if you're going back to, actually, I'd love to touch back on something you talked about earlier about really understanding what's happening within a business as well. And the businesses that have used their point of sales solution really well, to really know what customer order is in advance, to be able to predict. And so most of the big QSRs have really good point of sales or POS integrated with some sort of AI. So to be able to have really
good forecasting.
Good forecasting. And we see that in particular with some of them that are even starting to draw in data that's outside of the business itself.
Yeah.
What's the weather going to be like?
TV programs, weather.
Exactly. Yeah. Are there events?
Sporting events.
Exactly. Yeah. These sorts of things are going to either have an effect on diminishing the likelihood of demand or...
Interesting, because I see that happening with some of the smarter rostering programs as well to get your, based on your history and outside history. Fantastic.
I know that if I want to name a good QSR with a really good forecasting system, and that's Subway, for example. And Subway have had this for many years and it's just gotten better and better. Their ability to be able to forecast how much bread that we talked about bread before, how much bread they need to bake in time for
awesome.
To make
bowl yes.
Yeah. is phenomenal.
And I talked to a food consultant a few years ago and he was just saying there is now so much data and the ability to process it is so much smarter. And that was a few years ago. It's even more so now. So, and that kind of processing is not just kind of high-end IBM. This is now just in your Misty or your... Your local food app or your point of sale stuff. It's fantastic. Yeah.
And what I think one of the challenges is around this is that so many businesses that will go the hog and get great technology don't always know what to do with it.
Yes.
And this is great where perhaps a consultant can come in.
Yes.
Or, for example, one of the things in Fight Food Waste Limited, which is the parent company of First CRC, our other arm of the organisation that I'm working with now, we have something called the Australian Food Pact, where food businesses sign up to the pact, which is a voluntary agreement, where they commit to reducing their waste, which obviously means we're going to become profitable and reduce waste. But what we do in the organisation is we work with the businesses to help them and encourage them in developing their food waste reduction plans. But as part of that, it's like, what data do you already have? Like,
yes,
how can we use
yes,
that? We already have
yes, let's use all that. Yeah.
A lot of people already have.
Yeah. Well, I know that consultants I work with who go into just small businesses, the first thing who put their hand up for help, the first thing is, let's look at the numbers you've got. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, really? There's so much stuff.
It's hard though, because many businesses are just too busy opening the door, and making sure they've got enough staff today.
Yeah.
Do I have enough staff?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know about you, Ken, but you know, I walk down the local streets and every second business has a little sign on front saying,
yeah,
front of house staff.
Various degrees of desperation.
Kitchen staff wanted, like,
yeah.
Really need staff.
Yeah,
and we know this is potentially an effect of what's happened over the last couple of years, but it's focused where businesses are challenged.
Mm.
Can't open the door some days because they don't have staff.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
cutting their hours a bit because they don't have staff.
Well, this has been an awesome conversation, Diane. Really so stimulating and giving me, I learned so much from doing these podcasts. One of the reasons I love doing
them. And I love the episodes that you've had already so far. Some really interesting guests you've had.
Thanks. I try and find, the best experts on different topics, and it's really enjoyable. So we definitely hit pay dirt today with your contribution. Where's the best place for people to connect with you, find out online what you're doing, et cetera?
Mm. So there is the Fight Food Waste CRC website and the Stop Food Waste Australia website. We'll give a good indication of the sort of work that I'm involved with. And then, of course, then there's also my own website for the stuff I do on the side. Like, as you know, Ken,
Diane McGrath.
DianeMcGrath.com.au. And that sort of stuff is quite, it varies so much from consulting right through to, as you know, over the years as an astronaut candidate, but now this is a exciting news to share. I'm now contracted to be a circumnavigator in the Clipper Round the World Yacht Race. So that's in 2025, so a couple of years' time.
Okay.
11 months at sea.
Wow. Bit of training and preparation for that.
A little bit of training. And I live in Canberra at the moment, so not a lot of big seas out here.
No. But, I had one of my brothers used to take people on the Sydney to Hobart yacht virtually every year. And, boy, the training that they had to do beforehand, it was, I mean, because he was so obsessed with the safety too. But it was, wow. Oh, good for you. This is awesome.
Fun. So, yes.
Yeah, a woman of many parts.
Whatever random thing she's doing. But mostly it's usually focused around food, because who doesn't love food?
Yeah, nice. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Ken.
Thanks for joining me. I hope you're feeling inspired after listening to this episode. You'll find the show notes and links for today's episode on your podcast app, and look for the link at the top of the hosporeset.com website. Don't forget to subscribe to the weekly Hospo Reset newsletter and connect with Ken Bergen on LinkedIn and on Twitter.